This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
BBC Sounds. Music, Radio, Podcasts.
Thirty years ago, the idea that someone using a computer thousands of miles away would be able to steal your life savings or collapse the NHS would have been seen as fanciful. Not today. It's all too real. Individuals, businesses and governments are being targeted online by criminals home and abroad every few seconds. And as upsetting as the thought of having your bank account emptied is, it's probably not as scary as the prospect of a rogue nation seizing control of our energy grid or nuclear assets. In the second of our three-part mini-series looking at how resilient the UK might be in dealing with potential future crises, we ask how prepared are we to cope with these cyber threats? Step inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. Joining me in the briefing room to discuss all this are Emily Taylor, CEO of Oxford Information Labs, Sadie Creese, Professor of Cybersecurity in the Department of Computer Science at Oxford University, and Dr. Aybars Tunçdoğan, Reader in Digital Innovation and Information Security at King's College London. Emily Taylor, the most basic of the basics, what is a cyber attack?
Well, funnily enough, there's not really an agreed definition of a cyber attack, even though this is a term you hear bandied around all over the place. But in most cases, it involves deliberate access to a computer system without authorization, you know, with a malicious intent. So there's an involvement of bypassing the controls, whether they be human controls or technical or physical controls.
Aybars Tunçdoğan, a cyber attack takes different forms. Could you just tell us the basic ones?
Well, essentially, it can take three different forms or a combination of that. Technical attacks exploit flaws in software or hardware. So this can, for instance, include edge cases where a system behaves differently than from what its designers intended. And then there are human-centered attacks that you hear a lot about. For instance, when the attackers are tricking people into downloading malicious software or sharing credentials. And then physical attacks involve breaching the organization's premises. In practice, these forms often blend within a single operation. So for instance, an attacker might first compromise the access control server to harvest key card data, then clone a legitimate badge and impersonate a staff member to get past security, and then finally steal devices or copy the data from them.
Right. So given that, how would a typical attack work in very general terms?
Again, there isn't a single typical attack, but the overall flow is much like a burglary. So attackers may spend time casing the target just as burglars watch a house or a shop, learning routines and weak points before they strike. And then other times, as with burglaries also, right, the attack is opportunistic. They might spot an easy vulnerability, such as an unpatched system, and then exploit it for profit.
Right. Sadie Creese, again, in very general terms, who carries out these attacks?
Well, there's a wide range. Fundamentally, of course, there's cyber criminals. Sometimes are teams of people or organizations. Some of them find the way in, they sell that. Some of them are selling tools to enable you to move around the victim's organization. Others are actually stealing things, sabotaging things, demanding ransoms. So that's cybercrime. We also worry a lot about state-sponsored groups. Here you can see there's an overlap. So sometimes we know that there are some states that are allowing cyber criminal gangs to operate from within them, and then money is funneled back towards the state. In other environments, we worry about cyber attacks as being part of a wider aggression. And of course, in conflict, we see it too.
Emily Taylor, that's quite a variety of different people who are trying to gain access and trying to attack. What can we say about motives? Are they as varied?
The motivation can vary from, you know, the basic trying to extort money out of the target. And in ransomware, you see that happening twice. You know, I can unlock your data if you give me money, and then you can give me money again to prevent me from publishing the data. We call that double extortion. So there's a money element, and there's definitely a serious organised crime background to that. Then there's also just gaining strategic advantage. If we're thinking about government targets, critical infrastructure, there is definitely a geopolitics element there. So you would see state actors or state-sponsored actors really just trying to gain access, like an extension to spying, to find out what's going on, that reconnaissance, but also to gain strategic positions for the moment where you might want to trigger it. And we've seen an example in the last year of the Vault Typhoon episode, where the US government issued an advisory about a Chinese state-sponsored group who had gained strategic positions in communications, energy, transport, water and wastewater facilities.
Sadie, what can we say about the scale of cyber attacks at the moment and the trends that we see in them in terms of how much of a problem it is and how much of a problem it's going to be?
It's big and it's growing fast. I appreciate people would expect me to say that. There are all sorts of statistics available to us, but a couple from a report from April this year: UK businesses encounter a new cyber attack every 44 seconds. About one in five consumers fell victim to cyber scams. Now, you have to take that data as an estimate. It's a proportion of what's seen and what's measured. But what we can say is there are more and more actors moving into this space. It's getting easier for them to deploy these attacks. And because we have a growing dependency on cyberspace and digital stuff in general, it means that there's going to be a higher level of attraction because harm can be done and that harm can be monetized one way or another.
Thanks, Sadie. Right, I want to move on now to the specific threats. And here we can go into a little bit more detail. I'll start firstly with, if you like, the big one, which are threats to government and threats to national infrastructure. IBARS, what can we say about the targeting of government or national infrastructure these days?
Essentially everything, from nuclear power plants and the power grid to telecoms, the NHS, and the local councils are being targeted. So all parts of the government infrastructure can be a target. Because government systems are often interconnected with each other, breach can also allow the attackers to pivot to other systems, so that we call as lateral movement. That can then cripple services or allow the data to be altered or stolen. And then when the data is stolen, it can afterwards be weaponized in multiple ways.
Emily Taylor, can you give us an example of a relatively recent successful attack and talk us through it?
So last summer, several London hospitals stopped being able to process blood tests, blood transfusions, and that was because of a cyber attack on a pathology services provider, Synovis, that provided these services to a whole range of hospitals and loads of GP services in South London predominantly. And the disruption lasted months. So there were cancelled operations, blood transfusions and so on the first day. It's estimated that tens of thousands of appointments were disrupted and one person is thought to have died as a result of that, very sadly. But also the, you know, you're still getting updates from June until September from the victims of this cyber attack. And it shows you how stressful it is, how long it goes on and how difficult it is to recover.
It's very interesting because I think a listener might say, well, what's the point of that attack? I mean, the objective can't surely be just to kind of take down some diagnostics and so on. So what were they trying to do?
They were trying to get money. And when you think that the cost of the attack to the provider Synovus is estimated to have been 32 million, wouldn't you, in the shoes of the CEO and the management team, be tempted to just pay the ransom and get your data back and get up on your feet?
So in other words, what we were looking at was a ransomware attack on a company linked to the NHS, and the knock-on effect was significant for the NHS.
Yes, indeed. It's what we call a supply chain attack, and we're seeing more and more of these. As the public sector defences get harder to breach, then the weaker points become the businesses, sometimes quite small businesses, that are providing key services to these huge customers. So you take out one of those and you can have this massive disruptive effect.
Right, but it's not the NHS paying the ransom in this instance, it's the company.
Yes, and the fact that it took so long to recover suggests that they didn't pay.
Now, I imagine, say Decrease, that some attackers, once they get into a government system, they might just want to sit there sucking up data for a while without kind of announcing themselves. But how apparent will it be to a government that they've been hacked? I mean, how long does it take to find out if you don't get a ransom note?
That's variable. It's very possible to conduct an attack without detection, particularly where the tools being used are essentially new. So by that I mean when they conduct the attack, they're exploiting a vulnerability we did not know we had in the system, and therefore we're not watching for somebody to essentially attack us that way. Or, on the other hand, also, they might be using people on the inside that are trusted and not known to be threatening. So in those situations, you essentially have a vulnerability that you don't know about. If that gets compromised, then the attackers can be inside your system for a very long time, sometimes years, and often the detection of it does not happen until there's some harm noticed. So that might be a system stops working, or data that was stolen is offered for sale on the dark web, or in the case of ransomware, of course, the ransom demand is made.
Right. Can we move to the question from government to individuals, i.e. us, the citizenry? Emily, can you take us through how individuals are being targeted? What methods are the most popular used against us to try and do us over for our money or for something else?
Individuals are being targeted all the time by scammers and fraudsters with a variety of offers. Typically, they would be a text message or an email or an advertisement that you see on social media that's showing you something that either makes you frightened or very excited. And it's extremely, if you like, market-led, you know. So at the point in the year where we're all having to do our tax returns and we're all panicking about our tax bill, you tend to see a wave of text messages arriving, threatening people with fines, impersonating the tax authorities. They sort of bypass your rational self, get you panicking, click the link, and then take you to somewhere you shouldn't be. So it's either about harvesting your credentials or getting you to pay money, and sometimes identity theft as well.
Sadie, are there any examples that you can think of recently which have really taken your eye about how innovative these attacks on individuals can be?
Well, I think perhaps the most recent one that's incredibly concerning, of course, is deepfake. If we think about us as people, we tend to trust what we can see, what we can hear, what we can judge as true for ourselves. And often many of us have been told, you can never be proven to have been doing something wrong if you were never there. But deepfake technology is completely turning that on its head. And it's a very scary prospect for very many because it's becoming so easy to produce media that looks real, that shows people doing things and saying things that never happened and they were never there, and yet it looks exactly like them. So much so that one can imagine that this is going to become a source of extortion. And if you think about the consequences of that for society and for individuals, that's a very worrying future for our children to have to cope with.
Ibaz, can you think of any recent examples where deepfakes have been used to extort significant amounts of money?
In 2024, last year, a finance worker in Hong Kong was tricked into transferring about $25 million after a video meeting. What they did, the attackers did, is they cloned several employees' faces and their voices, including the CFO, chief financial officer. And then when the finance worker was on the meeting, basically everybody else on the meeting were AI clones. So the person thought that they were talking to their colleagues as well as their manager, but then all these people were fakes.
Can I get this straight? This person thought they were in like a kind of Zoom meeting with all these other people, and they were all deep fakes.
Yes, every single one of them. Their faces and their voices, and quite natural behavior as well.
Emily Taylor.
There's a growing threat of sextortion, which is young boys are usually the target in their teenage years, and the attacker will pretend to be somebody that they know in their class, and they will think that they're having an intimate conversation with someone from their class, be persuaded to share intimate photographs, and then the attacker reveals themselves. In many cases, the victims have taken their own lives as a result, after trying to pay off the extortion.
How do they know who's known to the victim?
From their Instagram pages, from their connections. You know, we really enjoy being online and being in social media, and our friendship groups are there for everybody to see, including bad actors. And of course, it's devastating for the families.
Sadie,
yes.
Is money the only motivation here, or do people, or are there a variety of motivations for people cyber attacking individuals?
I think it's very often about money, but there are other issues. Believe it or not, there are people who are nasty enough to be motivated by simply undermining trust in society and community and reputation. For example, consider this. If a hospital or a healthcare organization was sabotaged, so nobody trusts medical interventions, they won't present for operations or go and seek help, that ultimately damages people. But it undermines trust probably in the government, and it undermines general trust in digital infrastructure. Now, that's not necessarily being done for money, but that kind of undermining of society certainly happening. If we think more about individuals, though, these threats go deeper. We've heard about a form of online child abuse. There are many. There's radicalization, there's online bullying, spreading of disinformation, potentially undermining agency, democracy, social trust, access to services, people not reaching out for services. Essentially, there are people motivated simply to do harm. And what cyberspace is presenting is another environment in which these kinds of motivations are being expressed.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
Right, I think it's time we move on from scaring people to talking about, actually this may scare them too, how prepared we are for what is there and what's coming. And look at government first, because that's a big scale. So, Emily, how ready and prepared is, let's say, our government to deal with the scale of problems we've been hearing about?
We've heard that the scale of problems is immense, and you only have to be lucky once as an attacker, and you have to be lucky every time as a defender. But it's really interesting to reflect on the evolution of the UK's cybersecurity national strategies. First of all, we didn't have one until 2011, so that's approximately, you know, 10 or 15 years after most people started to come online. And what prompted that was a cyber attack on an Iranian nuclear power station. And that, and you can really see how that influenced the thinking behind the strategy. It's all about protecting government systems, particularly critical national infrastructure. Then you fast forward to 2016, with an investment of $1.9 billion. The government's obviously thinking, we have to go wider than the government only. The market's not going to sort itself out. They established a national cybersecurity centre and also made links between cyber defences and economic prosperity. And then our latest one, 2022, is talking about a whole of society approach. So we go from protecting critical infrastructure in 2011 to this is far too big for government alone and we have to work with international partners and it's up to everybody. So it's really a recognition that this is almost a systemic societal problem.
Sadie, what do you think?
I think there's some good news. Speaking from the UK perspective, we have some of the best inside the workforce across critical infrastructure, inside financial sector. We also have some of the best inside government. Organisations like the National Cybersecurity Centre are leading and thought leaders. So we're in an excellent position compared to peers around the world. The bad news in the UK, similar to other parts of the world, we are underinvested. It turns out that our adoption of cyber technologies is not just speeding up, but our innovation pace is speeding up. So we're introducing new stuff all the time, new ways of living, new ways of working. And that means that we need a commensurate amount of resilience. We need ways in which we can ensure that we can rely on this, the integrity of it, that it's going to be there when we need it, that we can trust it. And we are underinvested. We don't have enough people in the workforce. And we don't have all of the knowledge we need to deliver the protective measures that it's going to take to be resilient. We know you can't have 100% security. This is not about preventing all risk. This is about enabling us to take risk and having the resources we need to ensure that when things go wrong, we carry on going.
Wow. Ibaz, we all know from being in organisations where they do fire drills that people do things to test the system to find out whether they work. What's the equivalent when it comes, let's say, to governments protecting themselves and us against cyber attack?
The equivalent of that is penetration testing. So penetration testing is the offensive testing, stress testing of the technical, human, and physical layers. So involves things like trying to hack into the systems, getting some ethical hackers, some people who are knowledgeable about how to attack the systems, and then seeing basically regularly whether they're able to get past the defenses, whether they can trick your employees into giving critical information, and also physically trying to break into your organization, which is called as physical penetration testing.
Emily Taylor.
When we speak to cyber defenders in critical infrastructure, they are very stressed because they are thwarting attacks all the time. You know, when a successful attack gets through, it's on the news. What you don't see is all the effort that it takes to keep organisations safe.
But do you think that organisations still are sufficiently security conscious, spend enough money on security, think enough about it?
I think it's changing, it's evolving. In the last 20 years, our societies have been through an extraordinary transformation. And of course, we're all learning all the time and being constantly surprised by what technology can do for us and how it can go wrong. So can there be more done? Yes, absolutely. Will we see things that we didn't expect? Absolutely. Are we spending enough? You can probably never spend enough or do enough to keep yourself 100% safe. The focus in recent government strategies has been on resilience, and that's probably a bit more realistic. You know, you can build your moats and your castle walls to all your heart's content, and you should in a way, but you should also think, what do we do if it all goes wrong?
I'm going to ask Sadie in a moment about how to boost resilience even further. But Ibaz, before I do that, I just want to ask this, because when we talk about cyber attacks, particularly on governments, the assumption always is that other people are doing it to us. So let's fess up about this. Are we doing it to them? Wouldn't any state actually want to try find ways of getting into competitor state systems?
Yes. So different states are probably right now pre-positioning on each other's systems, because think of it this way. Cracking the Enigma code during the Second World War through the Bletchley Park efforts, it was possible. But imagine if Enigma code was available before the war, and they had started working on it and they had cracked it already, and then they went into the war, how much easier cracking the other side's communications would have been. So that is essentially happening right now. Many states are trying to hack into each other's systems, and they're trying to maintain that access so that if the time comes, if a war actually begins, they are going to then start abusing those privileges they have on each other's systems. This we call as pre-positioning.
Sadie, let's now come down to resilience proper. What do we need to do to really boost resilience? I mean, let's imagine for a moment, I am tasked by a minister to approach you and say, Sadie Creese, what's got to go into any significant strategy to boost national resilience from cyber attack?
Gosh, big question. And here's some ideas. On the vulnerability front, particularly with technology in mind, we cannot shy away any longer from thinking about how to incentivize the development of hardware and software and training data sets to ensure that it has less inherent vulnerability before it goes into the supply chain. There will always be some vulnerability, and resilience means we need to be able to tolerate that and keep going. So then we need to look at leadership in our government, but our organizations, critical infrastructure, and we need to help our leaders build their appreciation of cyber risk so that they can make investment decisions that put cyber resilience into the DNA of their organizations, because it's in the DNA of society. And then there's a third element, I think, which is really about, if we can't get rid of all the vulnerability, we need to build into the system some ability to deal with it on our behalf. So we've got to try and incentivize some innovation. There may be a huge market opportunity there. And then finally, and I think this is the other side of the coin to the earlier observation of penetration testing, we should consider mandating that in certain critical organizations, certain exercises must take place on a regular basis. They must consider contemporary threat scenarios. We need to make sure that the people inside our organizations are preparing, exercising, simulating this, and doing this under realistic stress. Because it doesn't really matter how much you pen test, you still have to prepare for the worst case scenario. And so I think that would be my answer.
Thanks very much. Emily, we've talked about the threat of AI and all those kind of deep fakes. But the immediate question, I suppose, is can it also be part of the solution? Can we use it to help us?
Yes, we're seeing an increasing use of AI, very imaginative use in the scam baiting area. So scam baiting meaning somebody goes out and deliberately engages with scammers rather than doing what we all want to do, which is avoid scammers. They go out there, they marry the African prince, they fall for all the scams and everything. We know a very prolific scam baiter called Kit Boger. He's got a massive YouTube channel. And what he's been doing is using AI to impersonate himself as a granny who then goes out and wastes scammers' time on an industrial scale. And he's also getting from them all sorts of information about dodgy bank accounts, where they want him to send the money as this vulnerable granny. So it's an AI bot army of grannies.
And that's all we have time for. My thanks to Emily Taylor, Sadie Creese and Ibaz Tunçdoğan. And just before we go, a quick reminder that you can subscribe to the Briefing Room podcast on the BBC Sounds app, and you'll get access to the entire back catalogue, including the first part in our resilience mini-series focusing on climate preparedness, the one about the ransomware threat, and the one about how close the UK is getting to the EU. We'll be back at the same time next week. Goodbye. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Sally Abrahams, Ben Carter and Kirsty Knight. The production coordinator was Rosie Strawbridge. The sound engineers were Dave O'Neill and James Beard. And the editor was Richard Varden. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon.
I'm Tim Hayward, presenter of The Trip, coming soon to BBC Radio 4's Understand feed. Psychedelics, a category of drugs that induce altered states, are having something of a moment. Over 10 episodes, I'll be diving deep into a rapidly evolving landscape, from an inflatable head to the glands of a particular toad, from the past and into the future. I'll be asking, what does it all mean? That's The Trip with me, Tim Hayward. Listen first on BBC Sounds.